Welcome to a special three-part series of AFP Conversations, The Road to Treasury Optimization, where we take a deep dive into how the treasury landscape is transforming in the Asia-Pacific region, what you should consider when you're looking to enhance liquidity management, how has the pandemic accelerated finance and treasury transformation, and what does the future of digital treasury look like? We answer these questions and more. The series is a companion to the Executive Guide, A Treasurer's Guide to Centralization. If you want to learn more about the topics covered in this series, visit afponline.org/treasurycentralization. That's afponline.org/treasurycentralization.
Hello, I'm Jeff Glenzer, AFP's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer. In this episode, I sit down with Scott Engel, Group Treasurer at AIA Group, and Peter Wong, Executive Director of Structured Solutions Development at Standard Chartered. In our conversation, Scott and Peter will talk about future-proofing treasury using technology and data. We discuss the ways in which technology and data are having the greatest impact, and what the future of a digital treasury will look like. Before we start, I want to thank Standard Chartered as the official underwriter of the Executive Guide, A Treasurer's Guide to Centralization, along with this podcast series. Now, let's dive into the discussion. For those joining us on the podcast, Scott, please introduce yourself, tell us about AIA and your scope of responsibility.
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Many people may not have heard of AIA. We are a relatively old and new company at the same time, founded in 1919 in Shanghai. For many years, we were the key Asian subsidiary of AIG. And as a result of the financial crisis, we were spun off in 2010. Today, we're the largest life insurance company in the world by market capitalization, approximately 100 on the Fortune 500 companies of the world. In terms of scale and size, we operate across 18 Asian markets, uniquely in Asia. And we service about 36 million policyholders with a balance sheet of just under $400 billion. I'm the group treasurer based in Hong Kong. We're listed and headquartered in Hong Kong. So I have overall company responsibility for managing liquidity from a high ground moral perspective, if you will, and also direct responsibility for managing cash flows at the group center. Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
So, Scott, I mean, that seems like a pretty big portfolio to manage out of treasury. Could you tell me how large is your treasury team and how are you structured globally? Are you centralized, decentralized?
Yeah. So there's a combination here. Now, so I mentioned that we operate in 18 markets and each business is locally chartered and locally operated. So every business, because it's regulated in its local markets, operates as an independent company. And because of that regulation, of course, we don't move funds across markets. You know, we sell local products, retail, we're a retail-focused company, in local currencies. And as a result, we generate local liabilities, and we take those proceeds and we invest them in local assets. So a great deal of our liquidity management, if you will, certainly from an ALM perspective, is done in country and not centralized. From a centralized perspective, probably the most important thing we do is provide architecture and infrastructure that all of our business units use in their treasury functions and their liquidity management functions. And we provide governance and risk standards that everyone complies to. So centralization is really about enabling with tools and technology and also controlling through governance and compliance. And then, of course, as the corporate treasurer, I'm responsible for the cash flows that take place at the corporate center. Some of the most important cash flows for us after policyholders, of course, are taking care of our shareholders, and all of that's managed at the group center.
All right. Thanks for that, Scott. I appreciate it. Peter, if I could ask you to please introduce yourself a little bit about Standard Chartered Bank and tell us about your role within the bank.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. I have about 20 years of corporate treasury background, and then I have spent about 3 years with one of the big four as treasury consulting, And 5 years ago, I joined Standard Chartered. Here in Standard Chartered, we have this structural solution development function, which started back 2013. So we are about reaching the 10th year anniversary. So our role here in the bank is to look at co-creation opportunities with clients. As the market has been gyrating, interest rates going up, regulatory rules are changing. We see both the business transformation on the business side with more digital channel and also new business. And that's one thing. And then the treasury is also moving more and more from paper-based check to more digital payment. And the implication is actually moving more towards real-time payment and real-time liquidity. For our clients like AIA, who operate on a very complex landscape with different regulatory constraints and so forth, we need to brand what the business model will look like 2 to 3 years down the road, and also what the technology infrastructure required and what the bank can support. So it's a complex role. I work closely with our product team and also our relationship manager team and sales team in order to address the needs of the client. So it's after COVID, the challenges has gotten even more bigger.
Thanks for that, Peter. And I'll be coming back to, heard you talk about some transformations that you work on clients with. I'll be coming back to that in a bit. Before I do, if I could turn to you, Scott, could you talk about the ways in which technology and data are having the greatest impact on AIA's treasury function? And how is the role of treasury and how it contributes to the larger organization evolving through these changes?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jeff. I guess maybe a little context is helpful. And historically, and certainly the case for AIA, we have relied on our data capacity through our principal financial architecture system to feed or to fuel our treasury activities, our cash management activities, for example. Now, that treasury architecture has been built on the cash management module that rests in SAP. What that has allowed us to do is to build a robust and stable cash forecasting environment. At the same time, what it's prevented us from doing because of the nature of SAP is to build out a data set that includes information from a wider variety of data sources that would be helpful in building really useful analytic engines. So let me give you an example. SAP, which is fundamentally an accounting system, not really a transaction system, by definition, because it's an accounting system, it goes through, depending upon your company, but in our company, a semi-annual close where all the transaction data in the system is locked in anticipation of financial reporting. As a consequence, it doesn't provide a facile base for dynamic day-to-day cash management activities. And to the extent, for example, when we brought Swift data into the environment, we had to build a subledger in SAP in order to capture all that Swift data from the banks. That was a pretty significant activity for us in terms of doing it. But what Swift wasn't able to do, for example, is to capture data from the policy administration system. Policy administration system, which is really the core retail client system, is the system that tells us when payments are due, when payments have been made, what the expectation is for payment cycles over time. It tells us if payments are annual, semi-annual, monthly. So that level of granularity was not easily captured out of our parallel policy administration system and brought into SAP. What's happened really, if you think about it, with the advent of cloud data sets, is we can create a data mart now that's agnostic to the SAP environment and pull in data from SAP, pull in data from Swift, pull in data from our policy admin system, and a variety of other smaller sources, amalgamated in a standardized, very clean, controlled, and governed way, and off of that larger data set, which is now efficient to operate because we're doing it in the cloud, we can run analytic engines that can do our forecasting, can look back at historical data and model most likely outcomes. So in a sense, a lot of the texture that was provided in the forecasting by people who had experience with these items can now be built out directly into data sets to feed algorithms and analytic engines that can do a lot of that. And we can take those people and ask them to do more interesting things than just trying to apply it to cash management. Let me stop there and see if it answered your question, Jeff.
It did. I think it's fascinating to see how the technology that you're using can both limit opportunities and create opportunities when paired appropriately with other solutions. It's interesting to see how that's evolving. I guess a corollary question for me would be, with that change and moving from primarily an SAP solution for cash management, and I know that's just a portion of your portfolio, how have the changes that you just described for us impacted the people that you're seeking to hire in treasury, as well as the skill sets of the people the skill sets that you're trying to develop for your existing staff?
Well, the obvious change, right, the most telling change, is that essentially we need data scientists, because what we have are people that are working with data, people who can design algorithms and understand how to build analytic engines that can look at data from a number of different perspectives in a highly automated fashion. You know, we attach to the analytic engines the Microsoft BI visualization tool. And so this is a tremendously powerful tool that if you have someone who can understand what managers and business leaders need from a liquidity and cash perspective, as far as information is concerned, you can design the visualization output in this tool quite you know, specifically. And as a consequence, the key then is to have an engine in the middle that's been well designed to give you the data in the way that you need it so it can be presented to management. So I think the big change is that we're looking more for data scientists that can understand data and understand algorithms that drive these types of analytic engines. You know, it's kind of interesting. We're a life insurance company, as I mentioned earlier. You know, we have, I imagine, I don't know, I've never done the count, but I bet we have thousands of actuaries. And essentially, they're data scientists. What do? They take large data sets, right? And in our main business flow, obviously, I mean, I don't mean to be morbid about it, but they take data sets concerning mortality. They look at huge historical information bases. And from those information bases, they build models and derive algorithms to estimate a given population's proclivity for, you know, dying, as it were, essentially doing exactly what data scientists need to do in the space of understanding how we manage our cash flows. It's a little hard to retool actuaries because they're really into being actuaries and really into life insurance. And so it's quite a journey to find data scientists who aren't shy going head to head with, you know, a lot of math geeks that are actuaries and do the kind of work that we need. But it's quite interesting. You know, I'll just as a digression, I'll tell you, you know, my hero, my model on this, already 4 or 5 years ago, I met the guy who at the time was the deputy treasurer of Microsoft, and he told me that the number one talent that he was hiring were data scientists. Sort of like data scientists? Well, you're like, what do you mean? And then he basically described to me exactly what I just described to you, that they had moved to a data mart environment in a cloud environment so that they could then take huge amounts of data from many systems and feed it into analytic engines and push it through their own Microsoft, you know, BI visualization tool, Power BI. And he was doing that 5-6 years ago. So in a sense, you know, they were the technology leaders, and now the rest of us are finally catching up.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting for us as a professional society. I think there's important points to be learned in that from people who are interested in a treasury career, is how to take responsibility for evolving their own skills, and what is the role of traditional treasury skills, however you might define that, versus the skills needed around technology and data. So given the examples that you've provided from AIA, as well as what you've shared with Microsoft, I hope that those who are hearing this podcast will think about how to invest in their own skills so that they remain relevant as organizations continue to evolve, as yours has. Peter, I'd like to ask you now, if I could, with companies like AIA and others, of course, and your role in, as I understand it, partnering with clients to develop solutions to help them in their transformations. Can you tell us how the bank is evolving to help clients capitalize on the opportunities being created through innovations around data and technology? And what can you do to support them in their transformations?
Thank you. If you look at cash, like what Scott has mentioned, we have a look at the three different dimensions. First of all is visibility, how we can visualize how much we have in the bank account, and more importantly, being more proactive and anticipate when and how much will be coming. Secondly, is really control. We can't control when the customer will pay us, because that's a function of pricing and also market demand. But with a better data management, we should be able to have a range to anticipate and what will be coming. And with that control, meaning that you look at the whole treasury process as a value chain. You started with operating process with agency or broker or bank assurance, pumping in new business to the insurance company, or for that matter, FMCG client, buying new brand and so forth. If you have a strong dollar, suddenly the local price will increase substantially, and then they dampen demand and so forth. But then after you have the cash, the question is how much of that is allocated and so forth. So the control in the past has been quite decentralized, because it is like it's something that is difficult to but if you turn it around and say, okay, we want to control initially 50% of the cash, and tomorrow maybe 80% of the cash, the higher percentage you can control, that means you can predict with more accuracy how much dividend you can pay, how much new, I would say, war chest you have to buy a new company, and also be able to have much more certainty on pricing. Because if you anticipate a more stable function of cash flow, it's like a stock pricing, it's a low beta. So that's control part. The third one is actually allocation. Life insurance company is relatively constrained by the policyholder funds not being able to commingle with funds in other countries. Having said that, most of the non-regulated business, unlocking the trapped cash in one location and being able to use them on another is important, because first on the capital rationing, and secondly is on the currency choice. Because if you allocate all currency in dollar today, you'll become a hero. But then you don't know when, turning back the clock, say 10, 15 years ago when QE started, dollar will become, the villain. So that's why the most challenging part is what Scott said, and anticipate the future. And you can control the data and you can anticipate the future, the more certainty you can do in terms of allocation. So I think digitization offer us a whole spectrum of a possible frontier that we can harness, but certainly the challenge is how to break away from, as Scott said, legacy data constraint using ERP. As ERP, they are designed for a different purpose.
Yeah, thanks for that, Peter. And I know for a data-driven treasury, as Scott talked about earlier, certainly bank data is an important input. And can you tell me a little bit about how the bank has had to evolve to meet those data demands of clients like AIA?
Yeah. Historically, banking is like any other service. It's a fulfillment of certain obligation. For example, you pay a claim, the insurance company or any other company send a file to the bank and we release a bunch of checks or telegraphic transfer. Or we receive a bunch of checks and we put it in a lockbox and then we credit in different accounts. We don't really want to know what those flow will mean for the next month, for the next year of cash flow. But so we evolve from a transitional completion to a more like a partnership. So today, you look at the whole value chain. You have started with the ERP, TMS, and now with the Microsoft the AI functionality. But the bank provide two very important ingredients. It's like in cooking a dish. You need data, the original data of who pays and who received. And secondly, is your bank account structure. You can have a bank account structure which is quite a zero. I mean, it's zero basis, not in parallel. So so you don't really have, it cannot make sense. But if you connect that into like a, for example, what I'm trying to work out is in-house bank design structure, account structure where the bank can actually provide a structure which can make sense, which account is served for what purposes. And then try to map this against with the specific chart of accounts of the company. If that happens, then actually it means that the data provided by the bank can be synchronized with the accrual process of the company. And that would be more useful. However, you need two to dance. So providing bank data is one thing. Changing the MIS, the ERP or TMS, is another. So it's often time when you we conflict a TMS to try to achieve what you need. It needs quite a bit of time. So I think that's a lot of, in addition to the data scientists, which Scott mentioned, I think nowadays a lot of the treasury talent are also subject matter expert and also a good communicator because they have to talk to the business and try to understand something. And in often time when you work with the cloud provider, they are software as a service, and they don't quite understand your business. So you need to communicate to them what exactly is what you need in order to come up with something useful.
Okay, thank
you. The role
of
bank is definitely changing. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Peter. Going back to you, if I could, Scott, sounds like you've gone pretty far through this transformation that you described earlier, but I'd have to imagine it wasn't all smooth sailing. Can you give me, give our listeners, I guess I should say, a little bit more insight to kind of what were the most difficult parts of the transformation you went through from either a technology or a cultural standpoint?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Of course, culture change generally after you've invested in a significant infrastructure is always difficult. You know, I think what has finally arrived in I hesitate to say it this way, but finally arrived in our industry is the appreciation of how data can be used to enhance customer experience. You know, sort of something along the lines of what Amazon figured out quite a few years ago. We didn't think in those terms in this industry. And, you know, maybe banks got to that a little bit sooner. I can't say that all banks do that. You know, I can think of a few that don't exactly have good customer interfaces at the retail level, but certainly in my industry, we were a bit behind on it. So the general shift to recognizing the value of data in enhancing the customer experience, that shift arrived at our company maybe 3 years ago. Well, you don't snap your fingers and create an environment where you can capture, clean, and govern data and then convert it into applied situations that improve the customer experience. That doesn't happen instantaneously. But we have a CEO that was quite adamant about this. He came from a data environment at another industry company in China, where they were quite far along in using data to improve customer experience. So in a sense, I got the advantage of riding on that coattail, recognizing that essentially the capture of data will allow me to improve the customer experience for my customers, which are essentially my business units. And so I've been able to do that. So the heavy lifting of culture change, fortunately, was led by our CEO, simply because he recognizes that for us to stay at the forefront of our industry, we need to convert data and to improve customer experience. And for me, that's an application that I've been able to apply in treasury land. Along the way, yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, you're seriously invested in an existing process. So to disengage from a process that everybody likes using, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, and building out new processes, you know, that takes time, effort, and energy. But I come back to the same point. The foundation assumption for our shift to a more active use of data and analytics in a digital environment is first and foremost focused on improving the customer experience. And when you improve the customer experience, you increase retention and you increase repeat sales, both characteristics that are very important if you're in a retail business like ours.
Oh, thank you for that. And I have to say that's very relatable to me. It's I was in sales early in my career, and while I didn't like it, I will say one of the things that was really helpful was a focus on customer. And one of the things I often ask staff, or particularly when I'm interviewing people, is to ask them who they view as their customer. And unfortunately, for so many internal operational roles, people think, well, I don't interact with a customer. And every transaction has a customer in it. You know, you talked about business units and so forth being your customers. And so that's something that's very relatable to me. And one of the good things I took out of my brief sales career was that real focus on always knowing who your customer is in every transaction, even if it's not a traditionally defined customer. So I think that's an important mindset for people to have as they look at doing their jobs. Peter, if I could bounce back to you a little bit, you know, you have the advantage of looking across a very broad client and prospect base that you work with, either in existing relationships or as you look at establishing new relationships. Could you share, you know, based on that kind of broad perspective, what are the most compelling opportunities you see for transformation that are being under-leveraged by treasury teams?
I think I have a lot of good lessons learned from Scott. The first, I think, is the ownership. I think, obviously, AIA has been in the forefront of taking ownership of cash and being the center of excellence and also the process owner of cash. Basically, Scott is designing something that can first starting with a good infrastructure and then be able to leverage that. I think that's the first thing I see happening in the industry, that more and more insurance industry, they're setting up a treasury center in Asia. More companies are setting up a treasury function, not just the number of headcounts, but the ambit of their responsibility. So that's number one. And number two, I think what we learned from Scott is their service mindset, internal customer. It's not just happening in the insurance industry or life insurance industry. Obviously, we know under the previous QE environment, low interest rate, IFRS 17 and so forth, the challenge to earn net interest income depending on how fast you can invest and how much risk you can take. But after COVID, one thing we learned in the manufacturing industry or FMCG business is that inventory in transit can be a drag in your cost or your working capital because of the lockdown and all the uncertain supply of inventory parts, such as semiconductor, and also the cost of it because of commodity inflation. So I think the mindset is changing from just in time to just in case. And therefore, the ability to control how much cash you anticipate and how much buffer you can release is like giving additional capacity in the insurance industry is to invest, but for the other industry is to put more capital into a working capital like inventory and also sometime longer AP period. Because during COVID, a lot of the SME, small and medium sized enterprises, they're under stress because of cash flow problem. And because of the gyration of interest rate in the U.S., actually, we have seen there is a lot of headwinds facing by these companies in Asia, because they are sometimes they borrow in US dollar or their receipts is in local currency because their payment is in US dollar. So all these require some support from a big company, big MNC, and therefore we see a lot of clients actually see cash not so much as a means of survival, but actually as a competitive advantage. So taking ownership and also having a service mindset is a very important. And I'm seeing a lot of companies, they are starting to put emphasis on talent, infrastructure, and also process. But at the same time, we see the business model are changing. Nike is looking at Nike Digital, Nike Direct. So they are looking at not just the traditional distributor model, but a more direct model. For exactly the same reason Scott mentioned, data. If they can control how much data, they can control the or understand the buying behavior of the customer, and therefore they can have better loyalty. So this all this change and move to another point is that the traditional way of cash management is more on the batch process, like we follow the sun, right? But actually, every day is every hour is connected transaction. So it's like 24/7. And this environment is going to accelerate because in Hong Kong, for example, we have the FPS started in 2018. We already have FPS faster payment system exceeding the transaction of check already, like 60-40 in the favor of instant payment. So if we see 5 years down the road, instant liquidity or real-time liquidity, real-time treasury means the traditional batch processing is a little bit out of date. So I think treasury would have to prepare.
Yeah, thank you for that, Peter. I think I'd like to, I think this is probably our last question. And for that, I'd like to turn to Scott. While you've talked about what's obviously a pretty significant and successful transformation you've been through, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you would anticipate is the next evolution of AIA's treasury, or what will be the KPIs on which the success of your treasury will be measured in the coming years?
Sure. It's a good question, Jeff. I guess I would reframe it just a little bit, and I'd go back to the importance of the fact that we're a retail-focused company. You know, in our business, your experience in buying an insurance policy is quickly forgotten, whether it's easy or painful or whatever it is. And basically, your relationship with a customer is entirely driven by his experience in claims. And so the ability for him to have an enhanced customer experience from a claims perspective is really what drives customer loyalty, repeat business, continued sales, persistency, those kinds of things. At the same time, in a sense, what you've decided with that is that you're always going to pay a claim when it's due, no matter what. But then you have the main conflict that comes into play, which is you don't want to have a lot of cash sitting around waiting for the claims to show up. So really the connector here is to figure out how you have enough cash to be able to have every single claim paid in a swift and timely fashion, in a fashion that's easy for the customer to experience. So it's not a long, elaborate process, but it's a straightforward process. So for example, in our business, we've redefined claims payments so that it's been much more highly categorized and value identified. And a huge amount of our claims, which are much more routine, are straight through. As soon as we receive the claim digitally, for example, in our China business, much of those flow through the WeChat application. It's processed immediately through an algorithm, falls within a category, falls within a value, and within minutes, the payment is made. And so this changes the whole dimension of what you need from a cash perspective. You need enough cash all the time, but not too much cash, because you now are shifting to an environment where an ever-increasing number of your claims are essentially real time. Now, we won't ever get to the world where every single claim is real time, both because markets are different and so on and so forth. But if you take our China business as an example of where this could go, what I have just described to you is a reality for our China business. And a significant portion of those claims are paid or submitted and paid within 60 minutes. Well, for heaven's sakes, that completely redefines your need to be able to have the right amount of cash and liquidity available all the time, but not too much. That's the rub. And so the smarter you become in understanding most likely outcomes, claims patterns, claims amounts, the granularity of claims, and you connect that to the pattern of cash availability, you need huge analytic engines to be able to make those fit correctly and optimize on both sides. Because in the end, having a little bit too much cash, if you lose the customer, doesn't really do any good. So you need to have the two parts fit together so that they couple well, and essentially the experience that the customer gets is fully met by our capacity. It's a good question.
Well, Scott, what I'll say, it's really refreshing to ask a senior treasury executive about KPIs and actually have the answer be focused on the customer, an external customer, because so often, certainly there are metrics that matter, but really from an internal perspective. And I think what you've shared, going back to, I believe it was your CEO's focus on customer experience, and then all the way at the end of this, asking about what your KPIs are, it's again focused on the customer and customer experience. And I think that's a great perspective. With that, I'd like to wrap up today's podcast and thank Scott and Peter for your time today. I want to thank our audience for listening to our podcast. And if anyone has any questions, please feel free to reach out to AFP or email our Director of Treasury Services, Tom Hunt, directly at thunt@afponline.org. Thank you.
Standard Charter is the leading international banking group with a presence in 59 of the world's most dynamic markets and serves clients in 83 additional markets. Through its advisory, expertise, and solutions, Standard Chartered helps clients adapt for the future without compromising on today's transactions.